In the summer of 2014, Lucy and I were in Los Angeles, and there is a very large car museum there. And we went to the car museum. It's on Wilshire and Fairfax. And we went to this museum, and they had one of the things they had there was a driverless car that was there. It was a Mercedes. It was a very small car. And, of course, I want to go on it. Anyway, we go, we register, we do everything like that. And you go in the car. I don't remember the specifics as to how it was or how it operated. But basically, for me as passenger, so-called driver, in the driver's seat, which I wasn't, it was a bit nerve-wracking because the car, I didn't do anything. And I don't remember, again, the specifics, but it was sort of like I would tell the car to turn right at the corner or something like that, or push one button, and the car would turn right at the corner, etc. And it was not programmed enough to just take me, you know, on a route without doing anything, but I had to be involved in the direction of the car. And I had fun trying to find my way back to the garage that it came from because I wasn't trained in what I was supposed to do. And I went, did a Google search for ethics of driverless cars, and I found so many sources of the discussion of ethics of driverless cars, and I was wondering what it was. I had looked at this a number of months ago, and I realize now that I didn't find anything that I had found before. And what it had spoken about, the other things that I looked at, were accidents that took place. The story that stands out in my mind is there is a guy riding his driverless car, and he was killed in an accident. He was watching a video sitting in the driver's seat, and it says he was speeding, and the specifics of what happened was, first of all, he drove quickly all the time, they said about him. He was a salesman, he spent a lot of time on the road, and this particular time when he was driving, a truck came out of the side road, pulled onto the road, and he smashed into that truck. They say apparently what happened, and again, this was, I read it some time ago, an event that took place prior to that, that apparently the whole side of the truck was not painted or anything. So his system did not recognize that a truck had come onto the road, and because he was involved in watching his video, therefore his car did not slow down or didn't have enough time to slow down because he had programmed it to go too fast. And this was, I believe, in Ohio, if I remember correctly, is where it took place. And that was what I'd seen before. And then today, when I was looking at some of the sources, I found this article in Time magazine. I just happened to choose that out of the many discussions of the ethics of driverless cars, and it presents some of the questions very, very nicely. So if you'll forgive me, I'll tell you, he starts off, imagine you're driving down the Pacific Coast Highway. So that's Highway 1 in California. It goes from north of San Francisco, goes all the way down the coast, and it passes Big Sur. It has beautiful, beautiful vistas along the way there. It goes through Carmel. It goes through Morro Bay. It goes through all of these very, very... Huh?
Not anymore.
It's got the big landslides.
Oh, okay. I'm behind the time. Sorry about that.
In theory,
it goes that way, and it's a beautiful, beautiful highway, and it can be very nerve-wracking when you are driving on the ocean side. So that is, if you're going south, you're on the ocean side, and you're, you know, very, very twisty road, but it's beautiful. And anyway, you're coming down, and you have the ocean on your right side. You're going down south. You have, here it says Malibu, across the opposite lane to your left. Just as you're turning one of the road's blind corners, another car whips around the bend in the opposite direction. Its brakes have failed, and it is headed for your lane. So now, what happens? There's little room to maneuver, no time for human intervention, and your robot car now faces a decision. It could turn inward, slam on the brakes to avoid the head-on collision, but this would then, you're on the inside now, you're on the mountainside, and the other car that's coming towards you is on the outside. He's going to perhaps hit you. He's going to go over the cliff into the ocean over there, and whatever happens with him. Or else, your car can brace for the impact and keep both cars are now on the road, but potentially injuring you along with the other car and the passengers. Now, what it says is, in a crash situation, we don't have time to think about morality. In other words, you're driving, you don't have time to think out the problem, but for and what do? We'll act on instinct. We human beings will act on instinct, whatever way it is. So my daughters, whom I taught to drive, you know, they repeat to me when I'm driving someplace, they say to me, "You said hit the animal. Don't hit on the brakes because you don't know who's behind you or you don't know what's going to happen. And if there's a human life over there, don't do the instinct is to hit on your brakes when the animal runs in front." And we didn't have big deer in California, so it's different, you know. We had muskrats or something. No, there are no deer. No, it wasn't deer. That wasn't the issue. The issue was a small animal. So we act on instinct, but a computer, a fraction of a second. By the way, tomorrow, Shabbos morning, I may be saying things that are contradicting this about our process of thinking, but leaving that aside. But for a computer, in a fraction of a second, there's enough time to ponder the decision and what to do. What? When? When it has been programmed to think that way. So therefore, the computer in that same amount of time will be able to, I'm going to say it this way, figure out what should I do. I will say it this way. Should I kill the other guy? Should I take a chance on us both surviving? Or should I allow myself to be killed? Those are the choices. Are there any other choices over here besides... Those are three choices, right? I'm going to say it this way, kill the other guy, allow myself to be killed, or take my chances of a head-on collision over here. So the computer is going to, what? Is going to go through the process of figuring out what to do, but the answer is not going to be made by the computer, at least today so far. Who's going to make the answer? Whoever programmed the computer to do it. So now, what should be done over here? So what happens if there are more passengers in the other car? There are five passengers in the other car, and there's one passenger in my car. What happens if there are five passengers in my car, and there's one passenger in the other car? What happens if we don't know? So what would happen? Here comes another example that was given over here. I have a Google car, and there's an advertisement on the road for, I don't know, for Yahoo. So my Google car is programmed to go around the block so as not to see the competitor's advertisement. You know, I'm sure you've seen that people have apps on their phones today, shopping apps, which direct them to certain stores, and people may not want it. In other words, they're walking down the street and their app will say, there's a sale at this store over here, and people are being driven crazy by it also because their apps are telling them too much of what to do. So what about over here? Should the driver be able to override what is programmed in the car and to make a different decision beforehand? So now, without giving any answers to any of that, what is pointed out to the auto industry, to the computer industry, etc., etc., is that there has to be some kind of discussion about the ethics over here. In other words, you're not just creating a driverless car. You are creating a situation in which there are value judgments that are going to be made, and those value judgments have to have input, and they're going to have results. So let's say the Daimler and Benz Foundation is funding a research project about how driverless cars are going to change society. And there's a Professor Patrick Lin from California Poly who is going to be focusing on ethics, and he's written for a number of organizations, and he is involved with this. Now, I'm going to take an aside for just one moment. He has been convincing the auto industry that it should be thinking about ethics and working with them. And he's saying that in this early stage, it's important not necessarily getting the right answers to these ethical dilemmas over here, but to raise awareness that ethics will matter more as cars become more and more autonomous. Okay. I saw one particular site, Jewish site. I said, whoa, Jewish insight into the ethics over here. And then I was rather disappointed in what it said. This is what this site said. I will read it to you in full because I kept on reading it saying, I hope it says something. So this is what it says. Dear friend, it's official. There are driverless taxis on the streets. This is written August 2016. There are driverless taxis on the streets. It may be 6 months or 6 years, but they'll soon be everywhere, and they will likely change the way we approach car ownership. Who needs it? Commutes, ditto, and shopping, assuming that the drones don't corner that market first and, you know, bring in everything to us. It sounds like a page from a sci-fi script, but this is real life, and we are in it. If artificial intelligence continues to grow exponentially, and it seems to be a foregone conclusion that it will, then many of us will find ourselves with a lot of time on our hands. How will the market reform to accommodate so many consuming humans in a world where production requires so few humans is anyone's guess? Yes, it's scary. No, there is little most of us can do about it. Best case scenario. There will be lots of goodness to go around, and everyone will have what he or she needs in abundance. To quote the words of Maimonides, in that era, speaking of the time of Messiah, in that era, there will neither be famine nor war nor envy nor strife, because good will emanate in abundance and all delightful things will be accessible as dust. The one preoccupation of the entire world will be solely to know God. May it indeed be so. Amen. Posted by so-and-so on behalf of his organization. So I said, oh, what a letdown. What did this thing say?
Nothing.
It said, la, 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 we'll all go dance in the forest and everyone's going to be happy and everything like that without even making any acknowledgement that there are tremendous ethical issues that are involved in the whole situation, and just saying, oh, everything's going to be fine and we're going to all study Torah all day long. Now, we should do that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that, but that's not how you approach an ethical situation and say, what do we do over here?
Rabbi, excuse me. I have to understand something. Are these cars, they do not have an override?
A car, the case that I said of that person who was killed has an override. That person could have slammed on the brakes, but he wasn't paying attention. And therefore, he was unable to save himself. The cars, I'm sure, will always have an override. I assume that they will always have an override because there's always going to be a faction. One of the things in the, let's say, the Yeshiva University presentation of the discussion is there's a difference, at least so far, between highway driving and city driving, in that it is hard, it may be hard for I'm going to call it the computer, to recognize the difference between an old person crossing the street and a child crossing the street. In other words, it may identify human figure, perhaps even size, but it may not be able to define more quickly. Is it someone who walks quickly or someone who walks slowly? So when it comes, a lot of this discussion perhaps today so far is, let's call it on the highway rather than in the city, because in the city there are many more factors that come in versus a limited access highway. Like, we all know there are speed limits. There's a certain place when the speed limit becomes 65, it's when it's generally an interstate with limited access. And if it's a road that has access, then it is at most 55, like the signs all say around here, state speed limits 55, because that's not that other thing, because that it's what it translates is that there are more variables that come about, and therefore you have to drive more slowly to be able to make the decisions in those particular places. And when you come to the place where it's 45, means that there are more, I'm going to call it variables, or people entering onto the road, people exiting from the road, there may be crosswalks or lights or things like that, so the whole speed is lowered when it comes to that. I assume that there will be override all the time, no matter how well programmed something is. But then the issue becomes that there's been an ethical decision has been made by who?
The guy who programmed the computer.
By the ethical commission of Ford Motors. Or maybe there's going to be a nationwide ethical committee. Or maybe there's going to be, let's have lots of fun, the insurance companies will have a say in this,
definitely.
Saying that, well, if we want to protect the safety of more people, we have to make decisions as to how many people it is better to treat and what degree of damage to various people. While one person who has a broken leg, for that person, it is, I don't mean it's a calamity, but it is a very serious thing that will involve that person and their family for years, because one person has a broken leg. And so how does all of this go? Okay, so here, now, just to scare you a little bit, it says here that John Kapp, GM's Director of Electrical and Control Systems Research, said in an interview that getting to the point where a driverless car needs to account for ethics will be a gradual step-by-step process. GM plans to offer a Super Cruise feature for highway driving by 2018.
That's next year.
But it'll still require the driver to stay alert and to take the wheel in emergencies. But that is, well, you all have cruise control in your car,
that's
don't you?
That's what it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Cruise control is exactly that. You set it at a certain speed. It's just one little thing, and you have the option to stop it completely, turn it off, put on your brake. I assume they all work the same way. And you have to steer. That still remains
right
with you as a necessity in order to operate it. But we already have that. We even have automatic steering. I heard that makes a difference between braking and going up hills and doing and efficiency. And we have automatic parking. Does anybody have that on their car here?
Sure, me.
No, she has it on her car.
You.
Okay. So it's going to be a while before cars have the capability to completely replace a driver, and we have no intention of promising that to a driver until the technology is capable of doing it. But it's something that isn't that far in the future. And then it says that a lot of this is mathematical formulas and mathematical problems that can be solved. But it's up to the manufacturers if they're interested in adopting these things in whole or in part. Now, the questions of the ethics are going to have to be made by someone. Okay.
They already have driverless trucks out west.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Trucks?
Yes, yes. It was a news item.
Tandem trailers.
Yeah. A news item just I saw within the last 2 months on the nighttime news. Maybe it was Nightline, perhaps. But it was a whole article about, I think it was beer company.
Yeah.
That they had, that was a picture of it. It has nothing to do with the drivers drinking or not. But that when you go on long hauls, you know, a cross-country driver, there are major stretches that are, you know, it's rather easy to have a driverless car there.
And
you
boring.
Can understand. It's very boring. How much corn can you see in the
and
middle
also,
of the United States?
The economy of this is that one of the problems that they face is drivers driving longer than their physical ability to stay awake.
So those are big issues. So you see along here on 84 where there are the rest stops, mm-hmm. and if you come by 84, let's say you're coming from 287 or 687, whatever it is, past Brewster, 684, and you turn into 84, and you come there, and you see at 7 o'clock at night, the rest stop is full of the trucks over there because they have driven whatever they're allowed to drive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are the monitors that print out or record how many hours they've been driving, and they have to stop and they have to do it. Now, there are places where there are ethical decisions already being made. Hospitals have these ethical committees to decide various things, and we have it, let us say, when it comes to organ transplant recipients. There is a so-called value given to different people as to who will receive an organ that is available. It may be age, it may be health categories, it may be many things that already these types of decisions are being made. So let's take a look a little bit at a Jewish approach to some of the questions that are here. Okay, now, he starts off, this is by Rabbi Flug of Yeshiva University, and he has it a little bit differently, the cliff story. That is, a driverless car is headed down a road at the edge of the cliff. All of a sudden, a large group of children appear in the roadway, and the driverless car has to choose between running over the group of children or driving his car over the edge of the cliff. And the car is going to choose based on the way it has been programmed to do so. So now, when it comes to at least approaching this question, believe it or not, it's much easier than we might think from a Jewish background. And it comes back to some of the classical sources that are always discussed over here. We know that a person who is challenged, is faced with a decision to make, whether to keep a mitzvah or to give up their life, somebody comes over, holds the gun to their head, and says, either you violate this mitzvah or I will kill you, you're supposed to violate the mitzvah. Except for three cases. The three cases are Gilui Arayos. He's starting with the one I'm saving for the last, is Gilui Arayos. I'm going to call it immorality, sexual immorality. Number two, idolatry. And number three is murder. If somebody says, go and kill this other person or I will kill you, a person is obligated to give up his own life. He's not allowed to kill another person to save himself. The Gemara says the reason is, my chas is de dama de dach samuk tve. How do you know that your blood is redder? Dilma dama de hai gavra samuk tve. Maybe the other person's blood is redder. In other words, you don't know that you're better than the other person. When it says you don't know that you're not better than the other, that you are better than the other person, means that you know that you can't say that you are. I am a concert pianist who is a neurosurgeon. And I also edited a cookbook. And the other person is a Bowery bum. And the person says, kill the Bowery bum or I'll kill you. I am no greater than the other person. I can't say that I'm greater than the other person. Everyone is equal, and therefore I have to allow myself to be killed. I cannot save myself by killing the other person. Famous, famous Gemara, which is the background for this. There is a Tosefta. Tosefta is from the time of the Mishnah, approximately the year 300 when it was written down. And it says that if there are a group of people and a terrorist demands of the group to either turn over one person and the terrorist will kill that person or he will kill the whole group, you cannot turn over anyone. So that is, sounds like, what? Not only am I not allowed to trade one for one, I'm not allowed to trade one for many.
How? Can you volunteer yourself?
We'll come to that. Very good question. Very important question. Let me, at this point, just say, if I can't kill, then I can't allow myself to be killed either, because suicide is also not permitted. So that would be suicide. I may contradict myself, but at this point, let's leave it with that. Now, if they specify a person, then they can turn over that person. There's a famous case in Tanakh, it's found in the Bible, in which they surrounded a city, and there was a particular person that they wanted, and they said, turn him over to us, or else we'll kill the whole city. And there was a woman there who said, throw the bomb out. And they did, and she saved the whole city because of that. And it is considered the right thing to do. Why? Because the terrorists, or the army, or whatever it is, specified a specific person and said, that give us this person. So the Talmud Yerushalmi says that there's a dispute.
As usual. Go ahead.
And then on the other hand.
Okay. There's a dispute whether that the case where they specify one person. Okay. So we have this. Now, what is this dispute that's found in the Talmud Yerushalmi? Reish Lakish says it is only permissible when the person is actually high of Misa, when he's liable to a death penalty. The case that I told you about of this Sheva ben Bichri is because he was liable to a death penalty anyway. So therefore, they were turning over whom? A person who was anyway, I'm going to call him a goner. In other words, that person had a death penalty anyway, and therefore they could. However, if it would not be that, and they said, give us a person, and they mentioned the name of the person, it doesn't matter. You can't turn him over. However, Rabbi Yochanan says that any time they specify one person, then you can turn over that individual. No matter who he is, he can be completely guiltless, and all the other people can be liable to a death penalty. You're shaking your head. What? Before I said this, it was all fine, right?
There was that famous story of this army sergeant who had he was a POW, and he was asked by the Nazi lieutenant.
So one sec, before you tell the story, was he Jewish or was he not Jewish?
Not Gentile. Jewish.
Okay, Gentile.
Okay, that's this Jewish. Is an important thing in this story
he
over here.
To turn over all the Jews in the group.
In the prison camp.
And they all stepped forward. They all said that they were Jewish.
He stepped forward first, and then all the others followed him.
Yeah, and then he told that Nazi, the SS officer, he said that this war is going to be over. And you're going to be brought up on charges as a war criminal, and he backed off.
And no one was killed.
No one was killed
in that case.
And he actually became a righteous Gentile.
He was a righteous Gentile, but he became honored by the state of Israel with that designation, with that title.
They've been honoring him.
Mm-hmm. So that case is the opposite here. That's, in a sense, it's can one person volunteer, right? That's like the one person volunteering there, which we still haven't said. But you're still shaking your head.
Because there's no answer. There's not a good answer.
Oh, one second.
Maybe a rabbinical answer.
Well, two parts to that. Number one.
Not that way.
Number one, I will tell you that the rabbinical answer is the correct answer. Number one, I'm saying that first rather than the other way around. And number two is a decision has to be made. You can't say, a person who's in the situation cannot say, I don't know what the answer, I don't know what to do, and therefore I'm going to sit with my hands folded. Yes, that is a possibility. There is, I don't know if I mentioned this here at some time, there is the book that was written after the war. It was called Min HaMeitzar. It was written by a Rabbi Reicher, in which he, who was in, I believe it was Auschwitz, was asked many, many religious questions, and he answered the religious questions, and after the war, he wrote down the question. And then he writes this question, which is very relevant to this. I'm just thinking why nobody quoted this, and why didn't I think of it before also in regard to this whole story here. That is at least this one portion that you asked about. It said that the Nazis were having a selectia, and it was going to be on Yom Kippur. And the Nazis, what they did was, they said that any child that was below a certain height would be killed, and that there was 10,000, whatever number, 100,000, doesn't matter, that we're going to select them, and we're going to kill them. And this man's child was one of those taken to be in the selectia who was going to be killed. And he then came to Rabbi Reicher and he said to him, I have a halachic question. And he said, I have a watch that I've hidden away, and I can give that watch to the guard, and my child will be saved. May I do this?
No.
So what did the rabbi answer him? It's written in the book. It's written up in English. It's called, the book is by Rabbi Rosenbaum, and it's called, I don't remember offhand. And he writes the story, and he says, so what did he say?
No. Sure. You'll give up the watch.
What's a watch compared to the child's life?
That's right.
Oh, did I leave out one part? I left out one part. He said, if I save my child, they're going to take another child because they have a number, a quota that they have to do. May I save my child or may I not save my child?
No.
So you know what he answered? He said, this is a very difficult question. And even... One second. You have to hear the whole answer that he gave. He said, this is a very difficult question, and before the war, a question like this, I would discuss with many rabbis, and I would take a look in many books. I have no books here. I can't look up the answer, and therefore I can't give you an answer. That's not the end of the story. The end of the story was that the man said, I know what you told me.
That I can.
No.
No. He could not say the words to him that you have to allow your child to be killed. It was, in other words, the halacha is that you cannot save yourself in such a case by condemning another person. You cannot. But he didn't want to tell the father that. He couldn't tell the father that, for every reason that you can imagine. And therefore, his answer was, I can't give an answer. And the father understood that his answer was, no, that you may not do it. And it says, and he writes this, and he said, and the father didn't save his son, and it was Yom Kippur. So he was doing this to show what a believing Jew would do with the most difficult question.
Couldn't the father have taken it the other way? He doesn't want to, the rabbi doesn't want to go against, like, former things So, but he would, so I'm going to listen to what he would say.
I will say this. He left him the option of acting according to his own conscience.
Yeah.
He did leave him that. He did not say to him, you may not do it, which means he left it open for him. If he would have felt that he could do it, he would have said to him, yes, go ahead and save your son. You're obligated to save your son. Which would have been, had he felt that it was permitted, he would have told him directly like that. But he didn't. He couldn't say that because he didn't feel it was right. But he couldn't tell a father to kill your son. I'm using those terms. And then he writes and he says, look what a believing person did, because he knew that that was what's right. So when I'm saying that a decision has to be made, and I said, I'm giving you that one example when the decision, so-called, was not made, but the decision was made and it was understood. But when it comes to the difficult dilemmas, then one has to act. You know, someone's in the
then house. Why would somebody, if the father knew the answer already, then why would he go to
the
rabbi?
He didn't know the answer.
Well, but you're saying he knew what the right thing, he knew what the right
only,
thing was.
Only after he heard from the rabbi.
I still don't get that.
Let's start off. The father has this choice. He doesn't know what he should do. Should he save his child or not? He goes to ask the rabbi, and the rabbi says, I can't answer you. So he understands from the answer that the rabbi gives that had the rabbi felt it was permissible to save his son, he would have said, save your son. So why did he not say, kill your son? Forgive me.
Okay, I see. Well, that's assuming the rabbi would always choose.
Yes. So the rabbi doesn't have a choice of saying, I don't know what to do. In Auschwitz or, you know, many places, if a rabbi says, I don't know what to do, and he doesn't say, call me tomorrow, that means that he cannot give a person an answer to something. Somebody asked me a question one time. So I told him, don't ask me. A person asked me about a certain thing, so I said, don't ask me. So what did that person, the person didn't do the thing. And so what did he understand that I was saying to him?
Right.
That you're not allowed to do it,
right.
But I'm not going to tell you because I don't want you, if you are tempted to do it, to violate, you know, something that I have said. It's not good for you, it's not good for me, it's not good for our relationship, it's not good for your observance, your all of that kind of stuff. And the person didn't do it, but I told him, don't ask me. So this was not a moral issue anywhere near the level of anything like this. It was something, you know, small stuff.
Can I drive to shore?
Don't ask.
Okay, I'm interrupting for 1 second. Somebody sent me a long time ago a story, and the person sent it to me, a member of the congregation sent it to me this week. I want to know your opinion. I know I'm going off here, but I've had this on my mind for some time. You'll forgive me. I want to read you this and then ask your opinion on this.
So, you want this on the tape?
Yeah, I don't mind it on the tape. I didn't name the things I don't want on the tape. I didn't mention the name of the organization that had the Let's All Go Dance Together in the Woods. I didn't mention that. Okay, this is the letter. It's a story. And some of you may have seen this, because I don't think I'm the only one who received this. And it says, enjoy this story from a member of the congregation. In an effort to better understand his Jewish constituents, the Gentile mayor reached out to a popular local rabbi. We had the mayor this afternoon at the thing for my mother. He was involved with the Eruv of our community, not him. The Gentile mayor reached out to a popular local rabbi. So the rabbi invited the mayor to spend Shabbat at his home. The rabbi made Kiddush Friday night on a full cup of wine. Then after the fish, he made a l'chaim on some fine scotch. The main course came with Israeli wine. They said grace after meals with another cup of wine. The next day in shul, after services, they made kiddush on wine, followed by herring crackers and a few l'chaims on schnapps. They went home, and the rabbi made kiddush for his family on another cup of wine, some l'chaim after the fish, a nice single malt scotch with the chullent, and some more wine after the grace after meals. When it got dark, the rabbi made havdalah on yet another cup of wine. Then, over supper, they enjoyed more wine and scotch whiskey. The mayor said to the rabbi, "Thank you for sharing your Shabbat with me. I had a wonderful time, and while I still don't understand why you can't turn the lights on and off, I definitely understand why you cannot drive on Shabbat." Probably got it from the same person. Okay, so I received this some time before, but now I've received it from a member of the congregation. So I'm asking your opinion. Am I allowed to say this on Shabbos?
What? No.
Say what?
This story.
Why not?
Why not?
Why not?
Okay.
We are a very sophisticated congregation.
I understand that.
There's
somebody,
a corollary to that story.
Anybody. One person will get offended. So what?
Okay.
There's a corollary that has started. It can't be said in mixed company.
So I would suggest that we therefore do not. Okay. Now, it's not my fault. It was your fault.
Okay.
You forced me to do that. But it's been on my mind for, you know, at least 2 months. It just came because it came from a member of the congregation. Now I have a different approach to it.
But you have to understand the congregation as well. You could not say that to any congregation, but I think you could say that to ours.
Okay, there was a general feeling here that
the Supreme Court says that it by a supreme majority that you can say it.
Okay.
Supreme. Right.
So one sec. Let's come back to our driverless car. We don't want to be rudderless now. The first case was about the famous case of turning someone over. The second famous case, again, we know, is the case that there are two people traveling in the desert, and one of them has a jug of water, the other one doesn't. If they share the water, both will die, because there's not enough water for them to be able to survive till they get to the city. If they don't share the water, the one who drinks the water will make it out of the desert alive. So what do you do over here? Do you share your water or do you keep the water for yourself? And just remember, just like in the last case, there's no such thing as saying you grab the gun from the other guy. There's no such thing over here as saying I will pray for water or a miracle is going to happen. That doesn't come into the equation or the discussion or anything like this over here. Forgive me, there are two opinions over here. Ben Petura says that it is better that both of them should die than one person should live and the other person should die. Rabbi Akiva says the person who is holding the jug should drink the water because his life takes precedence over everyone else. One's life takes precedence over everyone else.
Well, he has the water. I mean,
yes, he has the water.
It's his water.
Maybe God wanted him to.
No, God, you can't bring this. Is when it comes to many, many halachic discussions, you can't be frum.
He had the thought to bring the water. And the other guy didn't.
The other guy's a guzzler. And the other guy, they both brought water. They both brought the exact same amount of water. One guy drank it all up and this guy was shpurivdik.
Okay.
Right? And he saved his water or whatever. One guy lost his bottle. Whatever case you make, I'm looking at it right now. One guy has a bottle, the other guy doesn't. And I can't bring, forgive me, God, into this discussion. This is when it comes to a practical discussion or something like that. You can say, this is what I'm going to do, and I pray that this will happen, but you can't bring God into the discussion and say anything like that. So now, do these two cases relate to each other? In other words, in one case, it's taking the other person's life. Now, you've said a couple of things over here. One is you're taking the other person's life, and the other one is that you are...
In a sense, taking the other person's life.
No, you're not. You're not doing anything.
You're not saving
the other guy's life half the time.
Okay. If there's a principle of why is your life better than another person, so what difference does it make in the case of the siege that's laid on the city? What if they specify one person? If you say that no one person is better than another person, why should that have anything to do it? And the case in the Tosefta, what's the reason? Did I not say the reason why you keep the water? You keep the water, the Gemara says you keep the water because your life comes before the other person.
Yeah, yeah.
Your life comes first.
Even if you're not better, just because you...
So that's the question. If I, on one hand, I say you're not better than the other person, and here I say your life comes first. So are those two principles in contradiction to each other? These are two cases which are found there. They should not be in contradiction to each other.
Also, you can't commit suicide. You give the water away, you're killing yourself.
That's a good point.
Okay, that's a good point. So, the question is asked by Rabbi Yosef Karo. He lived in the 1500s, first in Toledo, Spain, and then in Tzfat, Safed in Israel. And he asked the question, when the terrorists don't specify a person, why can't the victims choose one person anyway? Because that person's going to die anyway, isn't he? Because they're going to kill everybody. And you can't say God is going to save them. I'm not picking on you or anything. And you can't say they're going to defend themselves. And you can't say that the cavalry is going to come over the hill or anything like that. You have to deal with the facts over here. If that person is going to die anyway, so you're not really saying that one person is better than the other or anything like that, but he's going to die anyway. So he says in answer that if no one is specified, then who is better than the other person does apply, because you have to pick someone. So if you're picking someone out of there, what you're really doing is you're saying that he is not as good as everyone else, or that so-called my blood is redder than the other person's blood. There is a statement over here that you should allow yourself to be killed rather than kill the other person is only if you are active. Means that the case I gave you is somebody says take the gun and shoot the other person. But if what you are going to be done is just being passive, then you don't have to give up your own life. So what is the case? When someone says that they're going to be allowed to be thrown on top of someone else and suffocate the other person. So they aren't actively strangling the person. They are just passively. They become like a stick that's thrown on top of the other person. What are your eyebrows saying?
My eyebrows are saying it's a very fine point.
Yes. It is, yes, but we have to come to an answer. So I am distinguishing between one thing and another. I'm saying the difference between actively killing someone and passively killing someone. I'm jumping way, way ahead. You're in the car, and the car is programmed to do something.
You're passive.
You're passive, right? So maybe there's a difference between when you're passive in the car than all the other discussions. So the difference between passive and active in this little hairbreadth over here will have a tremendous application in the case of the driverless car. What happens when you come into the car? But tell me why you are active. Now I told you why you're passive in the car.
Because you still have control of the car. They cannot make a car, but they shouldn't make a car that...
No, actually, by him getting in the car, he's starting it, so therefore he has some kind of action
in the car. But he could also stop it, too.
Or try to.
So one second. I'm going to ask you again. I'm just picking on you. I know that.
No, with this. Sorry.
In other words, when you stop, is stopping the car one of the options in our cases, our scenarios that we gave? In other words, one scenario is you're coming around the bend on the cliff. Stopping the car and stopping the accident altogether from happening isn't one of the options. I presented it. There are three options. You go over the cliff, he goes over the cliff, or you crash. That stopping the car isn't an option. With the way it was presented over here, there's a group of kids, and you're driving around the cliff. Stopping the car in time is not an option, because otherwise, I would say, it's obvious that's what you have to do. So stopping the car isn't the option. So you're saying what? Therefore, you're active because you didn't stop the car. Just fine line. Not stopping the car, is that active or passive?
Passive.
That's passive. Not stopping the car is passive, not active. Anyway, I'm jumping way ahead. There's all kinds of good stuff over here, so believe me that it's here. The question was asked as follows. What's called the trolley problem. The Chazon Ish discusses a case of an arrow, the Chazon Ish died not that long ago, in the 1950s, I believe. He discussed a case of an arrow, or let's make it a grenade, that's headed towards a group of people and will kill all of them. So can you redirect the grenade? The grenade is coming to you. Can you redirect the grenade? What are the things? Don't they always show this like in maybe cartoons, not in real life? You know, they lob the grenade over to you, and you catch the grenade, and you...
Throw it back.
You throw it back, right? I don't know if such a...
It's happened.
It's happened.
It's real. You got to be very, very brave to do it, but it's real. And you got to do it very, very fast.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're going to eat it.
Yeah. Okay. So, and how many seconds are there from the time they pull the pin?
It depends.
I think, if I remember correctly, it's not many seconds.
Ten.
It's less than 10.
Right.
Yeah. So what, you count to 10
yeah.
or to 8? And then you throw it?
Yeah, but the thing is, you throw it, and then it 10 to
you want it to be 10 over there. You don't want it to be 8 over there.
Right.
Okay? Because if it's 8 over there, and the guy goes like this and pushes back. So that's the question of the Chazon Ish. What happens? The grenade is coming towards a group of people and will kill them. Can you send the grenade somewhere else when it'll kill only one person? Let's make it, you're all on the same side. The grenade is coming over to your side. It's not an enemy that you're going to kill by throwing it, lobbing it back at the enemy. You're not catching it. You're just deflecting it from a group of people over here, and you're deflecting the grenade is going to go to one of your people who is over at the side and is going to kill him.
Or you fall on it by yourself.
Not yet. I have to see if we skip this. I'm sorry. The question is spoken about with the suicide. I think we skipped it, so I owe you for another week. But that's the...
because it's active.
So is that active or is it passive? The Chazon Ish claims that this is not the same as handing over one arbitrary person to terrorists who demand one person, which is prohibited, because in this case, the act is, in principle, a life-saving act, whereas handing over one person is an act of cruelty. In other words, in one case, you're taking a person and you're turning him over. And this over here is you're saving the lives over here. Corollary to that, resultant from it, is the death of another person. So you can argue, right? You can argue, and you say no. But this is the Chazon Ish says that. He said, nevertheless, he leaves it as an open question, because in reality, it is an act of murder when you throw the grenade to the other side and kill the lone individual.
But you got to understand something. This is all so theoretical. Because when you're faced in a military situation, you don't have time to think whether it's moral, immoral, or anywhere in between.
You want to stay alive.
Is the rule.
Okay, so coming back to the thing that I said in the beginning, that those types of decisions that are made by human beings are not made in a calculated manner, but they're made by instinct. Mm-hmm. But the issue is, can we control our instinct? Not here at all, but can we control our instinct, or can we not control our instinct? Can we change our instinct? Can the driver change their instinct to put on the brakes and not hit the animal that runs in front of the car if they think about it enough and they realize that they can be smashed from behind by someone and that they can cause a greater accident in human life if they do that? Can a person train themselves or be retrained, or can their instinct therefore be changed? Are we animals completely that we don't have any choice, or are we human beings that our so-called instincts can be changed?
Driver's safety says kill the animal.
Right. But that goes against our instinct. Our instinct is to hit on the brakes. So what we have done and we have taught ourselves to do is to override our instinct. So coming back to the army situation, the situation is a person saves their own life. That a person doesn't sacrifice themselves to save others. So what about the person who falls on the grenade? Well, that person, what have they done? They don't at that moment say, now let me see, the Rambam says I should give up my life, and this one says this, and this one says this. What do? They have come to a point in their level of humanity in which they say that two lives, or the lives of my comrades, is more important than one life. And my life is very important to me, but there's a whole group of people.
There have been many a posthumous Medal of Honor.
Yes. But what happens is, does that come naturally to a person? An army, I haven't been in the army. You've been in the army. What happens in the army? The army is that you negate the self and you become part of a larger component. You become part of a group, that you aren't important as the individual. You are important as part of a group, and you think for the group and what's the best for the group, etc., etc. Isn't that the principle of an army? That you're not an individual.
Right.
You're part of something else, this group, which is greater than myself.
Right.
So, in other words, I'm retraining my instinct to go against it. Against what would be normal or natural. There's a famous case. It's called Rodafe. Rodafe is if you see a person chasing after another person to kill them. What are you supposed to do? You see?
Kill that person.
Right? Someone's running with a sword, a knife, a gun, whatever it is, and you see that they're chasing after another person to kill them. Well, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to save the person's life, even if it means killing the person. And this is
as long as you're not saving your life.
As long as you're
your own life.
No. When you are being attacked by someone, you are allowed to save your life. Not only are you allowed to save your life, it says in the Gemara, Habala Horgecho, if somebody comes to kill you, Hashkeim v'horgo, get up early and kill him. In other words, don't wait for him
preemptive
to come.
Preemptive strike.
Right, exactly. Don't wait.
This was the argument used by Yigal Amir when he killed Yitzhak Rabin, because he considered Yitzhak Rabin as a rodeo.
Yeah, okay.
No, yes, sir.
Poor judgment.
Huh?
Poor judgment.
Well, that was his defense.
It was the court found him in poor judgment,
yeah.
And the court sentenced him to that.
Life imprisonment.
Yeah. But that.
Life imprisonment.
There are people who make various judgments and their own calculations about things, and they go ahead and they do whatever it is. By the way, let me at least come back to the water. When coming to the water. Do you think it would make a difference if the guys are partners in the water?
If what?
If they're partners in the water.
To begin with?
To begin with. It's just that I'm holding the water in my hand.
That would be a difference.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Are you allowed to steal in order to save your life?
Depends.
Yeah, that's
On whether or not you're going to do damage to the other person by saving your life.
If so facto, you're doing that.
One second. Now, here's a halachic answer, not an emotional answer. What?
So it's not murder. It's not sexual
immorality.
Immorality, or what was the
word? Idolatry.
Or idolatry.
Right? I am allowed to save my life by violating any of the commandments except for those three. So if I have to steal in order to save my life, I'm allowed to do it. So here are the two guys in the desert with the water. Can I steal the other guy's water? The other guy has the water. I don't have the water. Can I steal his water?
Well, you're killing him.
So that's what, right? In other words, it depends on the I'm going to call it the extent of the damage. If you're killing the other guy, you can't do it.
Well, you are killing him.
Right, so then you can't do it. In other words,
you can't kill him now and have the water. But if he dies from thirst, that's a different problem.
It is different.
I'm going to say this. Is that actively killing him or passively killing him? Okay, so we're going to leave that. I'm going to leave you with another case. I did come upon the cases as follows. It's told in the Gemara, the story of Lulinus and Pappus. What was the story over there? The daughter of the Roman emperor was murdered, and, surprise, they blamed the Jews. And they issued harsh decrees against the Jews. And these two people, Lulinus and Pappus, came forward and they said that they killed her. And they thereby saved the life of the rest of the Jews. So that's the case of the suicide in order to save another person.
Why did two of them have? Why can one of them? That way they saved...
their partners.
I don't have an answer. I don't know the answer to that. It's a good question as to why the two of them. It's more of a historical question. Yeah. Why two of them came forward rather than one? I don't know. But that's the story that happened. But the bottom line is that over there they did come and they did sacrifice themselves to save other people. So I'm going to now conclude with saying that the issue of the driverless car involves a lot of important ethical issues, and they are involved in the thoughts that are there. The end result that will come out of there, I don't know if it is known yet. There will probably, without a doubt, be the option for someone who purchases the car, or perhaps even when they start up their car every single time, to key in their own personal types of decisions. But these are things that really are too at the front of what is going on and what is going to be taking place, what is taking place, and what is going to continue to take place to an even greater degree in the very close future. It's already happening now, and more decisions are going to be made, and we individuals will have to decide various things. If I buy a Cadillac, I smash everyone else. If I buy a Ford, I sacrifice myself. Or if I buy a Cadillac, I reprogram it to do this or whatever it is. Not this
is a standard kosher reprogramming tool.
Yes, which I will say it this way. I'll say it this way. No, Linda, it's not strange. I got a call. Not here. When we lived in Austin, I got a call from somebody in San Diego. They said, I just want you to know what happened. We went into Sears to buy an oven. And we came in there. The guy was wearing a yarmulke when he came into the store. Excuse me one second. Hello? And the guy came into Sears to buy an oven. And he was very... Yeah, yes, in the top drawer on the right. Very important. Okay.
Yeah. That's where the knife is.
came in, and they walked into, they were buying a stove, and the salesman comes over to them and says, I have to show you the Shabbos mode on the stove, or the Shabbat mode on the stove. And what is it? Well, most ovens have a thermostat by which it works, and when you open the door, the oven cools off, you close the door. Sometimes the thermostat goes on right away, depends on how long you kept the door open, etc., etc. Ovens will, most of the time, an oven with a timer on it cannot be programmed for longer than 24 hours. And if you have a two-day Yom Tov and you want the oven to be on for the second day of Yom Tov, you can't program it for the second day. It will turn itself off after the first day and you can't do anything. So it was the Star K, I believe, in Baltimore that came to the Sears Corporation and said, listen, what can you do for people who want to be able to have the oven on its timer for more than one day? And they said, well, we'll create an override, which they did. And apparently this person in Sears, the salesman, had been told this by whatever hierarchy in one of the classes orientation that he went for it. And they said, by the way, we have the Shabbat mode on our oven that nobody else has. So he sees somebody coming in. He says, Shabbos mode people, this is the oven for you. So it already exists that there are certain, we'll call it the Jewish overrides that exist in very, let's call it elementary things. And certainly when it will come to more specific things, there will be there. If by the way, you know that Henry Ford, when he was first building the cars, it was, I think the Tin Lizzie was black. You could have a Model T in any color, as long as it's black. And it was very, very hot in the summer. And so a guy came over to him and said, I want you to know, I took one of your cars and I retooled it. And there's something very, very good. You might want to know what it is. And he goes into the car, turns on the motor, and he adapted air conditioning to the car. And he said, this is great, I want to have it. He said, okay, I will do that, I'd like to buy this from you. He said, okay, you can do this, but only on one condition. I will sell it to you for $1, but from now on the car has to be called the Ford Goldberg car.
And he was
he refused to do it. He said, well, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to pay you whatever you want for it. So he said, okay, it costs you $3 million. Henry Ford said, $3 million, much better than getting the name of Jews on my car. I'm very, very happy to do that. And he did that. And that's why the Goldbergs, when they established this whole principle of having the air conditioning in the car, they made sure that it always would say on the car, on the dial, high and low. And what was the third one?
Neutral.
No,
air conditioning.
And it was something like Mo in the middle.
Mo, yes. Mo.
So they had their first names. High and...
Are you joking?
Yes.